So, show 150. Is that...
Mm.
That's a bit strange.
Well, it proves we've got stick-to-itiveness, and we're going to, despite the adversity, keep hammering away at this thing until we make it the massive global international success that we envision.
Oh, yes. The original name for the company is Global Hyper Megacom, isn't it?
Well, we did toss around Packet Pushers Heavy Industries semi-seriously at one point.
Seemed like a good idea at the time. But, you know, congratulations. Show 150 in the weekly feed. Another 50 shows in the other feeds. That's a bit of an achievement.
Pretty happy about it. Did you happen to check how many total downloads we got? I think I saw unique downloads of 1.3 million pretty recently.
1.35, I think it was. Uniques and 1.7 or something. Let's see, June 11, which is when we're recording this. 1.65 total downloads. 1.34 unique downloads. It is June the 11th, and we're downloading them at a rate of 2,000 a day, give or take.
The second million is happening much quicker than the first million, and oh, if that were only dollars or pounds or some sort of currency that was movable.
Yeah. I'd take pennies.
Even that would be good.
Even pennies would be
In all seriousness, as Greg and I go back and forth, we appreciate everyone that follows the show. We got an awful lot of subscribers and listeners and feedback from the community that's pretty steady and constant now. And we are constantly amazed that anyone is paying attention to what we're doing. So it's really great that the show has grown in the way that it has.
Outstanding. And people have really supported us. People have sent business our way, told other people about the show, shared it with their audience. There's trainers out there who tell their classes about us. There's customers who tell their vendors about it. There's people who work for vendors who tell their marketing departments about us. And it's been a real good ride. Show 150, and we are progressively moving more and more into this being a business for us and putting us on a footing which sees us continue into the future. We don't see this ending right now, do we?
No, it doesn't look like it's going to end anytime soon, because what's happened is different companies are interested in engaging with the Packet Pushers audience. In other words, they want to use us and the podcast to share their products with you. And so we look at those opportunities and then bring aboard the interesting folks and try to have interesting technical discussions with them. And for the most part, we've gotten really positive feedback on that. So that makes it seem like the ride can continue.
It does. And the trick here is to find a balance, is to keep finding community stuff. So we started off just talking about networking, and we know that we don't always get the balance perfectly right, but we keep trying to bring it back and say a certain amount of community content where we talk about specific technical shows or technical ideas, or just have discussions where we get other people to join us. Like, you know, we've had the university shows, and a couple of years back we used to just talk about what happened during the week and news stuff. And it's difficult sometimes to find a balance in between all of the noise. You know, we've got so much going on in our day jobs. Ultimately, we are still network engineers who do things during the day, and the stuff we do here is the other day.
That's what I was doing 5 minutes ago. I just had to close out the window for a day job so that I could focus on Packet Pushers for a bit. But to follow up on what you were saying, Greg, we are really making an effort to have the community content there as well, so that it's not all sponsored content all the time, because we know people don't want that all the time, the sponsored stuff. So
I've seen American TV.
Yeah, exactly right.
Keep your heart
we do going. Have non-sponsored content. Certainly, we're trying to keep it there. I've got a couple hours on Cisco OTV coming up, which had nothing to do with Cisco themselves as an entity. Just a bunch of engineers that are talking about implementing it and so on. Show on multicast coming up that we're planning, and other stuff too, like this show. Certainly not sponsored content. It's just me and Greg, you know.
So, yes, today's show is just Ethan and I talking in a celebration of show 150, which is something of a milestone. We haven't celebrated any of them up until now, and we figured we'd just talk about stuff. So let me jump quickly to a topic. Up until now, our RSS feeds have been handled by Feedburner, and in the coming months, we're going to be switching away. We think that Google will eventually be shutting down the feed burner, RSS feed. So this is just a quick warning. We'll post more on the blogs and the website and talk more about an upcoming podcast when we actually do the RSS shift. But when we do, you will need to maybe change your iTunes subscription. It's not 100% clear to me yet. I think people using iTunes will be okay, but maybe people with slightly more obscure RSS readers like the Blackberries or the Androids, they may have problems, because I was reading something on the internet the other day and a lot of the iTunes, you know, the audio clients that download the stuff may not pick up the redirect that we put in place where FeedBurner will divert you. And they may pick up the redirect, but they may not pick up and update their RSS feed from the redirect, which is what they're supposed to do. So just a word of warning that we are making some changes in the near future to move off Google, because they're shutting down RSS, and FeedBurner will be part of that in the long term.
And we'll blog and tweet about that too and try to give everybody enough notice that they can update, because we're very well aware that the folks rely on the RSS pretty heavy to get the podcast and also to get the blog posts from the community blog feeds that are out there. So we'll make real sure to broadcast that when the change happens.
It might be a good point to point out that we do actually have four separate feeds, RSS feeds, speaking of. One is this show, which is the weekly show. There is the Healthy Paranoia RSS feed, where you can just subscribe and listen to the show, which is fronted by Michelle, or Mrs. Y, as she's more well known. And that's mostly focusing on security, but it's a great show. She puts a lot of work into getting some amazing guests that you really need to listen to. So encourage you to get over there. Then there's the Priority Queue feed. When we have too much content, which does happen, often we move it into the Priority Queue feed, and that's a different, or where it's too nerdy or too niche. Is that fair?
Too niche, I think, yeah, certainly. And then the content bursting was the big thing. For example, Greg and I will be covering Cisco Live this year, and we're going to be generating many hours of content as we record with Cisco folks at the show. Well, a lot of that content, some of that content is definitely going to hit Priority Queue, just because there'll be so much coming out at once, it would be unrealistic to put it all in the weekly show feed.
Yeah, it would just swamp you. And what we also found is that some podcast clients can't sort of download a client more than once every week, and you end up with missed shows in the feed. I don't know why. I don't have enough time to work it out, but one day we'll get there and see how it goes. Well, let's talk about Cisco Live in the U.S. What do you think we're going to be doing there?
So a number of things. One is we know that there are listeners and folks and people that follow us on social media that want to meet up with us. We'll be doing some tweet-ups. We haven't figured out details yet, but we're working on that. We are going on behalf of Cisco. So, of course, our another priority we're going to have there is to record a lot of content on what Cisco is going to be announcing and getting the technical details on whatever those announcements may be, some of which we have an inkling of, but, of course, we are not at liberty to say right now. But, typical for Cisco Live, there's going to be stuff that matters and stuff that the networking industry is going to care about, because they are major announcements coming from Cisco. So there'll be tweet-ups, a lot of different podcasts and so on that we are going to record there. And we are also hoping to do some recording with the community, where it is, an aside from what we're going to be recording for Cisco Systems Incorporated particularly, and it's going to be just us. So we're talking with Stephen Foskett and Tom Hollingsworth at the Tech Field Day. Those guys, techfieldday.com, gestaltit.com, about doing a roundtable session where we, without any Cisco people in the room, do a roundtable discussion regarding the announcements and maybe the keynote speeches and give our impressions of it, for better or for worse. Last year we did a social media get-together where anyone who had time in their schedule could meet up at the social media lounge with us, and we did an on-the-fly recording. We actually did that last year in tandem with Blake Crony at the No Strings Attached podcast. And we did kind of a simulcast recorded podcast of the goings-on there, and just walked around with a handheld mic. And that actually came out really well. That was a really popular show that we did. So we got a lot of – I'm sure we'll be really busy, I imagine.
It's exhausting, too, talking to people and then recording and then editing and then publishing in rapid succession is quite complex. and gets a bit trying at sometimes. I know that we will be getting together on 5 p.m. or 5:30 p.m. on Sunday. There's a tweet up scheduled with Cisco Social Media. Tom Hollingsworth is organizing it. It has a specific location, and it's for everybody to come along who's... You want to meet all those people, all those names that you met on Twitter, this is your chance to come and join in. I'll put a link in the show notes that'll tell you where that is. So I'm looking forward to finding out, meeting up with a lot of people. We will definitely try and organize a Packet Pushers tweet up somewhere where people who want to just meet us on the show floor, probably Tuesday evening, do you think?
At this point, Tuesday could work just based on the schedule that we've got. But I'd have to go back and look at what the whole schedule is, when the customer appreciation parties are going to be, and all those sorts of things to try to minimize conflicts, which is tough because there's parties going on every night and things that people are invited to. So we'll do our best.
And we'll do what we can.
Now, you know what? I'm looking over our schedule here for the show, Mr. Farrow, and it is notable that you have published a book.
Oh, thank you very much. Yes, I did publish a book, which has been very well received. I wrote a book about blogging. One of the things that when I meet people regularly is that they, and you have a conversation and you talk about things. And one of the things that people say is, how do you write so much? How can you just keep writing on and on and on? And part of it, of course, is just because I wanted to write and I always wanted to share what I had. You know, when I first started off blogging, it was about sharing what I knew with other people. And then my secondary motivation was to get other people to help me. So by writing stuff down and publishing it, getting people to validate that. And that's gone on into time. And over 5 years of blogging, I've got a bit of a process going as to how I can just write something and then publish it and then write again and publish. And I mean, you've been doing the same thing, Ethan. You write and publish quite regularly.
Yeah. Yeah, all the way back to 2007. And like you said, once you get into it and get going, you develop a process. And and your process is pretty well detailed in the book.
Thank you. Yeah, so I wrote down a book. It's partly a little bit of a motivation. It talks a little bit about why you want to blog and the advantages. And it's good for your career. It's good for your resume. And it's good for yourself as well because it forces you to think about things and to document them. And then I give you a process on how to write a blog post, how to write a 500-word article, because most people, the last time they learned English was in high school. And when you're in high school, the teacher says, when you come back from holidays, they say, why don't you write an essay about what you did over summer? I mean, that's not how you write a blog post. And so I give you some ideas on how to approach it and also some ideas about how to fit it in between the other things that you're doing. All you need is a text editor. So I've written blog posts in Notepad and then emailed them to myself at home and then published them later on. You can write them on other computers. And I'll give you a pattern to be able to do that. So there's a link to the book off my homepage. I've sold 150 copies, more than 150 copies so far, which I'm really excited about because the book originally started off as a blog post, which was, too long, and I wasn't happy with it. So I put it down, and then 3 months later, I picked it up and did some more. Anyway, I grew it out in an intentional book. So lots of people have written nice things, and I recommend it to you because they said nice things.
Now, your homepage being etherealmind.com, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And then link through. And this is an e-book, not a print book.
No, it's purely an e-book. You can download it from – we're using a site called LeanPub. The unique thing about LeanPub, which I'm really excited about doing again and again, is that you publish the book – and then everybody can go and download it. You get a Kindle, you get an EPUB, you get a PDF version. The LeanPub site will even send it to your Kindle, and you can download the EPUB and put it on your iBooks or whatever your favorite reader is. And then later on, I can publish a new version. So I've already published three versions of the book. The first version I published, and then a day later I fixed a whole bunch of mistakes that I found. And then it was out there for a week, and a whole bunch of feedback came back from people who read it, which was just awesome. And really good feedback from a bunch of people. So, and then I added some more stuff into that and then published it again. And my intention is to continue to rewrite that book into the future. So every 3 to 6 months, I would like to go back and add a bit more to that and let it to grow over time as my experiences change. And also as people send me their stories and add those into the book. The book is DRM free. Please go over to leanpub.com and search for my guide to technical blogging. And it just costs $3.99 US dollars. or $5.99 is the suggested price. So the Lean Pub thing says, this is what we think you should pay, but if you'd like to pay a bit more, please do. And, you know, some people have been truly great and paid even more than $5.99, which has been really, you know, it makes you feel good when people do things like that, doesn't it?
Yeah, no doubt. Hmm. No doubt. So, and of interest here to others that are out there that are bloggers that are interested in maybe doing something bigger and doing a book. Well, you know, I'm looking at what Greg has done here as a model that I might be following as well. And Greg and I have been bouncing around other book ideas that are worthwhile that could follow this model. And we think there's something to be done there as opposed to the model of going out to a Cisco press and trying to pitch an idea for a book and then going through that arduous process to write a 1,000-page volume that covers, you know, whatever it covers, you know, those big bricks that Cisco press tends to put out there. This is a quick and targeted and much easier. And if you're an author and you like to keep some profits after writing, doing all that work to write the book, well, it makes a whole lot more sense to publish the book yourself if you can.
We've always talked about doing this for a long time, haven't we? Where there's room for a book which is not 600 pages long. There's room for a book which is 100 pages long and just focuses on, you know, on a niche topic or a niche area. And, you know, the great thing about LeanPub is that 90% of the money passes through to the author, which is tremendous. So on that note, Brent Salisbury, who is Network Static, who's also been on the show and his website, he and I are about 70% of our way through writing a book on OpenFlow. It will be epic. It's almost 80,000 words, so it's full size.
Oh,
it's 400 pages, 400 PDF pages, 400 A4 pages on PDF. And
last time I talked to you, it was at 70,000, and that wasn't that long ago. You better have another 10,000 words. That's just
Last time I checked, it had over 300 illustrations as well. So it's full of diagrams, which is not something that a textbook normally does. But because of the way our publishing system works, it just allows us to be able to put, you know, hundreds of diagrams into the document. Let me check in here for you. I can just tell you. But it is a lot of diagrams, and that's really exciting because I always 160 diagrams, which is really exciting because you do a blog post and you have pictures in there, and that makes all the difference. You don't need to have lots of words to illustrate an idea, so I'm really looking forward to getting that out and maybe doing something a little bit different that normal books would not be able to do. And the idea behind the OpenFlow book is that as the OpenFlow standard changes, we will actually continue to update that over time, and you'll be able to get access to it.
Oh, that's great, and I'm really looking forward to that when it comes out. I've seen bits and pieces of it, what you've shared with me, and it's going to be quite good. And for those folks that are keen on understanding OpenFlow better, what it does, how it works, how you would deploy OpenFlow infrastructure, I am not aware of a book on the market that is actually covering that right now. So maybe someone's planning one or something, but
we know of two books that are under development, but they won't ship until towards Christmas time. And but we think ours is pretty awesome. Brent's doing an amazing job on some technology. I mean, he's reading the source code for the OpenFlow controllers to be able to add stuff to this book, which is just amazing.
Okay.
It's exciting too, right? It's just an exciting thing because as somebody who's blogged for free for all these years, it's just amazing to publish something and that's a thing, right?
Yeah. I think the OpenFlow book's going to do pretty well. And, it's funny, you know, you just hit on another point because going back to, you know, we didn't start as podcasters. We started as bloggers, both of us, you know, back in the day. You know, a lot of writing, and that has blossomed into these other things. So it's neat to kind of see it all come back around to writing again as the core thing. I think maybe that's what you and I love to do more than anything else.
Yeah, you're right, actually. I enjoy writing. I mean, we could have just packed up the blogs and gone on to the podcast and just do that. And a lot of people doing podcasting do, but we still publish blog posts and, you know, we write for some of the commercial magazines, the commercial websites too. And I think I get more fun about seeing an article published as much as I do seeing a podcast go out, really.
Hey, I wanted to circle back around to Cisco Live for a bit here. Mm-hmm. Now, there's little bits and hints that we've gotten that that we can't get into any detail on, but I think it's still there's some room here for us to make some predictions without upsetting anybody at Cisco. Did you have any particular predictions that you wish to share that you think is going to happen or maybe be announced at Cisco Live?
Yeah, I think so. I think we're seeing signs. I watched a video, a public video from Cisco this week where they're sort of saying, oh, we've got some big things coming up. And that sort of got me thinking, and I sort of had a bit of a think. And there's all the classic signs of a big launch. Like, so the big American multinationals like to sort of copy Apple, and they hold something for their key, you know, for their event, the keynote event, right? And if you look at VMware, they came out with their big bunch of stuff at VMworld. EMC came out with their new software-defined storage strategy at EMC World and a whole bunch of product announcements and, you know, that sort of stuff. And I don't see that Cisco would not be any different. So if you think that Cisco wants to bring something to generate some buzz and to really, you know, make – it's going to be their day. You know, they control the whole thing. What are they going to do to bring it out? Well, we know that SDN is big, right? And all the other companies have got to clearly define, you know, Juniper's got their Contrail, Alcalu's got NewArch, we've got Big Switch with their strategy there. We've got the Open Daylight Project, which Cisco is contributing heavily to. But that's not Cisco's strategy. That's a participating. And then it struck me that we've got NCEMI. We've heard all this stuff about NCEMI for 3 years. That's about the time that a startup incubator should go before it starts to deliver something, hardware or not, right? So the question is, will we see NCEMI launch? And I'm going to go public and say, yep, we're going to see NCEMI announced. No idea.
Well, it wouldn't be enough to say NCEMI is going to launch. It would be what specifically is the product set that is going to come under that label. And of that, I've only heard rumors about what that's going to be. It's going to be a massively scalable fabric controller. So for really, really huge high bandwidth Ethernet. So it's going to be hardware and software. But that's been a while since I've heard that rumor, and I haven't followed up on it to see where that's gone.
Yeah. I think there was a lot of scuttlebutt about NCEMI like 3 months ago, and I think there's been a big push from inside of Cisco to squash it all to make this into a big launch, right? I'm just guessing, right? I have no information, no insight. I'm not under NDA or any of that sort of stuff for this one, right? But I think that, you know, we've seen 1PK. We were introduced to 1PK last year at Cisco Live last year. So 1PK, which is the API for all the features in the switches. So if you figure that, you know, the iOS XR has now got 1PK agents that are starting to mature, we're defining APIs for all the things, software APIs, to be able to add and delete a static route and to add and delete an SNMP string and to configure a AAA and to configure MPLS by, you know, this 1PK API. We've got the ability to put software agents on the routers if we choose or keep them off. And so if NCEMI is going to come out, it would be able to provide you with an Ethernet fabric for your data center if it's hardware with a controller, and the controller will be able to talk to all the other things. And you know all this big push around the Internet of Things? So now you've got a software platform that could talk to everything. WAN routers, LAN switches, you've got your brand new Ethernet fabric, you've got your WAN routers out to the sides, you've got your MPLS edge, you've got your firewalls, and they're all going to be 1PK API enabled so that they can be programmed via software. So all that's missing is this controller at the top. And I think that's what NCEMI is. It's hardware and software.
We'll see if that's where it settles out at. I was thinking just raw data center capacity was maybe going to be a little more of the push, but and I say that in part because of Cisco One controller and where that's at and the effort that's gone into that and the fact that that code has finally settled out as what's going to be the underpinnings of Open Daylight and that project.
Well, so there's room for Cisco to do more than one thing. Cisco's a big company. So Cisco could easily have a project which is open source, like OpenStack, and they see the Open Daylight project really as being into OpenStack over time, perhaps. I have no idea. And you know, that's an entire initiative in itself that sits outside of Cisco, that's open source and covers all, you know, the free tards who want to have that type of stuff. But, you know, do you know what I mean? Like, you know, the Facebooks and the Rackspace. If it's not-
I do. And I agree that there's certainly room for Cisco to do more than one thing. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a fair bet to say that if Cisco, the existing Cisco controller code base that ends up being, if you think of ODL as the least common denominator, or it's going to be the common thing. Well, everyone else, every vendor that'll say, yes, our controller is ODL compliant, and I'm thinking in the long term here, because ODL isn't even really a thing yet, but it's ODL compliant, and then we're going to bolt a bunch of our super powerful extensions onto it that work with, you know, our hardware and make it do things that are even more wonderful, and I'm waving my arms around, I really am. To try to illustrate the point. and yeah, an NCMe controller, I think, I don't imagine it to be something completely different on the assumption it is a controller that's a part of the portfolio here. I wouldn't imagine it to be something completely different from what the Cisco One controller is, but it could be Cisco One plus wonderfulness that is Cisco specific. So, you know, extensions, if you will. Well, I'll throw another, you know, thought I had here about a cluster prediction. You know, one thing that we had talked about with Cisco last year in some of the meetings that we were in, we were at Cisco Live, was the notion of an SDN app store, which is something, an idea that I blogged about and that seemed to have conceptually some legs. Now, whether it's an app store or not, the idea is, you've got an app that is a network application that plugs into a controller and then adds functionality to your software-defined network. In a nutshell, that's kind of the concept that got thrown out there. And if you take some of what Apple's done with their app store, where there's some sort of a grown-up that's looking at the code and is saying, yes, well, this is trustworthy code from a known publisher and to some level of to some point, we bless this application. And then you build an app store. You create an ecosystem there that would enable software-defined networking to roll along. You could have an app that does something very small and simple, and you could have apps that do things that are very large and powerful. And the key being that controller that sits in the middle and is the arbiter between your applications and the underlying network infrastructure. I would like at least to see that if not an app store, some kind of an ecosystem built around 1PK gets announced that's more formal. Last I checked, it was still a beta program that required admission, you know, special consideration from Cisco to be involved to get at the APIs and to begin to look at code and write your own scripts against it and so on. I'm imagining it's about time for that to get opened up for the general public to start using it, sharing code bits with one another. And again, perhaps that app store concept could then build on that.
It's an interesting idea, because if you look at what we've worked with recently, you know, with the New Arch Networks, where we did a white paper for them, and we had the presentation from Juniper with the Contrail acquisition, and they're both building SDN type infrastructures based on controllers, and we still don't know. We know that the applications are fully integrated with the servers. We know about network agents and that type of thing. But it does still come down to, you know, where's your WAN accelerators? Where's your load balancers? Where's your monitoring apps to provide you feedback and dashboards? And
so I look at a Nuage, and it's an incredibly powerful solution, and it's very capable in what it does. No doubt about that. Mm. But it's a point solution. It solves a specific problem, or more fairly, a specific market segment's problem. You know, managing multi-tenancy on a massive scale, and then automating that, and then creating multiple data centers where all these guys can intercommunicate one another with one another, and so on, which is a problem the vast majority of networks don't have. Yep. You know, Nuage is going to sell that solution. There are people that are going to look at that and eat it up, because it's pretty wonderful.
It's a cloud networking solution, not an enterprise networking solution, perhaps.
Well, right. And what I see for enterprises is a great amount of differentiation network to network to network with unique requirements. And well, there's some certainly some commonality and problems that are similar that all of us enterprise networking guys face. There needs to be also a flexibility and the ability to share code and swap ideas. And I see apps and plugins as being a really nifty way to get the enterprise market's attention. Hey, enterprise, here, take our software-defined networking controller, add it to your existing Cisco infrastructure, and then you can take some apps, plug them into the controller that give you some new and unique capabilities, or maybe a different way of doing the same thing, but it's more efficient, or it's easier to get the job done.
I think there's two types of apps. One is task-focused. You know, configure a VLAN, add an ACL, count how many, you know, there's a lot of things that the apps could do that replicate existing functionality. But I'm also very excited about the opportunity for apps that bridge functionality from one thing to another. So, for example, I'd like to see an app. I do a lot of work in firewall clusters where a company has an internet gateway and they have a router, a firewall, a proxy server, a load balancer, an IDS engine, and an app that could configure all of those to deliver a service would be awesome. And if you could imagine it, it would, you know, I need an IP address? Yes, okay, get it from the pool, configure a rule on the firewall, tell me what's the internal, you know, all those tasks that we do that's just scut work, you know.
Yeah.
Get an internal IP address, get an external IP address, create a NAT rule, go to the IDS, add a rule to the IDS and tie the IDS rule to a security policy. Go to the load balancer, create a VIP, point it at this farm, you know, blah, 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 blah. You know, that's really morally satisfying if twiddling your fingers on a keyboard's kind of fun, but wouldn't it be better to automate that and spend your time?
Absolutely. It would be so much better to automate that. I had a similar thing with, I think I've given this example in the show before perhaps, but just a very simple, creating a VLAN and making sure it's accessible throughout your enterprise. Where you've created it, you've dealt with spanning tree if you need to, and you've dealt with your routing distribution so that that the network is available where it needs to be and is not available where it does not need to be. You've checked for address space overlap. Oh, you can't use that IP block because it's already in use here. You know, these sorts of things, all of which can be automated easily. Oh, your VPN tunnel backup needs to have that added to the crypto list. Automated. Why should a human being have to think about these things if you can build an app that allows you to define that policy and just off you go?
Yeah, VPN.
Plug the pieces in to the app, and then the controller handles it the next time around.
That's right. And you should spend your time traffic grooming or worrying about cost settings on the dingus instead of twiddling your fingers with IP addresses. It really needs to move past adding value instead of just getting it done.
But imagine if the ecosystem was there in place that allowed engineers to bounce ideas off of one another and share code fragments and roll those things into, you know, actual production apps. That would be great. And right now that doesn't yet exist with 1PK. And I think for 1PK to really have the impact that it can have, that's the piece that's missing. We need that platform.
We're gonna, you know, this gets down to the argument where I look at 1PK and I think it's an inspiring achievement in the sense that, you know, Cisco's not one CPU, it's not one operating system. I think there's 8 operating systems and they've managed to bring 1PK into each of those, like, you know, NXOS and iOS XR and CRS-1 you know, all those platforms. And all the variants thereof, right? All that hardware platforms have all got different requirements. And I think there's a lot of problems there. But if I look back in the history of networking, you know, the simplest, least complicated protocol always wins. And OpenFlow does everything that 1PK does, but differently, right? It's not better or worse, it's just different. And it's simple and it'll be universal. So if the parallel that I can draw is, if you remember back to the mid-90s, there was 2 management protocols in the day. DEC had a thing called MOP. And there was a thing called CMIP, which was meant to emulate it. And CMIP actually had a whole Telnet protocol, SSH, you know, it had encryption and all this stuff. I think it stands for Common Management Internet Protocol or something like that. And the idea was is that you didn't actually use Telnet IP to configure a device. You used CMIP, and it was SNMP. It had polling and monitoring and an interface and a CLI and all the things that you needed. And the only thing that the industry actually implemented was the competing proposal, which is SNMP, which was the simple version. And even 15 years later, we still don't have any advanced use of SNMP. The original idea behind SNMP is that there would be, you know, ongoing expansions and more variables and more development of standard SNMP interfaces, and that never happened. So, you know, the industry doesn't want massive APIs in networking. They just want something very simple that you can poll and get some data from. And I think that's why OpenFlow will win in the long run. In the long run.
Wow, I disagree with all of that, just about. Okay. So my logic is this. I think Cisco particularly has no use for OpenFlow, really. I don't think they see that as a way forward because it's a threat to their business model. And I have a hard time thinking that they won't win. I'm also not sure, based on what I've seen of the different 1PK library families, what all the different APIs are, what they cover, and how well they map to all the different Cisco hardware sets, that it's fair to say that OpenFlow does all the same things that 1PK does. I don't think that is really the case. I think OpenFlow is a powerful subset, particularly getting into 1.3 and whatever 1.4 is going to bring as far as things that you can do with it. But I mean, 1PK covers anything you can imagine that you would want to configure, tweak, or twiddle with on a Cisco box. There's a 1PK library that covers that. Whereas OpenFlow is not that broad. It doesn't pretend to be that broad. And then if you go back to a problem that we've discussed but that I think we both agree is probably going to be overcome eventually, is that of just OpenFlow raw performance in silicon. Now, Cisco has a real good reason for that to not, you know, to continue to be an issue that doesn't get solved, because they would rather continue to make their own ASICs and sell those to you at a premium, because that's a big part of their business model and their differentiation. They would really want to have a custom switch that they're selling you, that they've built their own magic into, and if OpenFlow doesn't map well into that silicon, well, screw it. We've got 1PK, and it does, and you can program your switch that way. So my cynicism is tempered by, or is rooted in, not that OpenFlow isn't simple and isn't a correct way forward for the industry, because I think it shows promise that it can be that, but I think it's too disruptive and that there's going to be such a backlash from Cisco and others, you know, against it from, you know, becoming a, you know, the way to program the forwarding plane of a switch, that it's just going to be very difficult for it to become exclusive, for it to become the one. I think it will be a standard, but I have a hard time believing it's going to be a broad displacement method.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see that argument, but I think my gut tells me that complex technologies like 1PK ultimately fail in networking, and we always end up going back to. So, for example, Ethernet. There was all these other great technologies like FIDI and Token Ring and ATM and, you know, X25 and Frame Relay and ATM and all those WAN technology, all those, you know, layer 2 technologies have all fallen away for the cheapest one and the singularly worst one, which is Ethernet.
Yes, okay? That is very fair to say. Yeah. Right?
So we could, if your argument holds true, then the industry would not have chosen Ethernet. It would have chosen FIDI or Token Ring, and we'd be running, you know, ATM in the backbone or something else. I think, you know,
well,
if
the Ethernet win because it was simple, or did Ethernet win because it was cheap?
It was cheap and it was simple. All the complexities of FIDI, you know, 64,000 byte frames, counter rotating rings,
yeah,
you know, all the things that, and that's why it was cheap, was because it was simple. SNMP and CMIP, simple. We had DECnet protocols, Apollo XNS, we had AppleTalk, we had IPX. Why did we default back to IP? Because it scaled and it was simple. IP is ultimately the simplest protocol of all the others. So compared to, and you know, we could have a contentious debate, but perhaps that other protocols were simpler, but IP itself has weathered the several times because it's simple. And I think that the debate versus OpenFlow versus rich APIs will all ultimately converge back to this is the simplest solution. And I think the thing that makes networking different from other areas of IT is that networking is just so massively distributed, we can't put complexity everywhere because that causes problems. So if I have to send somebody, you know, to New York to configure a router and do something that's complicated, I've got a problem. I always end up just bringing it back to the basics and to simplicity.
I feel that Cisco's market share and the fact that they are buried so deeply in open daylight now makes me feel that they've got a real good shot of manipulating the market in their favor for the long term. And that OpenFlow, which will be one of those great ideas that never quite gets the legs it needs to become ubiquitous.
Yeah, I think OpenFlow, yes. If I subscribe to that view, then OpenFlow may have achieved what it needed to do, which is to kick the networking industry into the next generation of change. To create a step, an innovation step that caused 1PK or... But, you know, if we're going to do 1PK, where's the standard version of that? Where's the version that can work with my firewall? Where's my open source version of that API that can configure my IDS as well?
And I wouldn't argue that 1PK is the alternative and it's OpenFlow versus 1PK. I think it's going to be OpenFlow is going to be there, but there's going to be all this other stuff as well.
Yeah.
And so there'll be some people that'll use OpenFlow and some people that just won't care. We're a Cisco shop and they're giving us 1PK and it does everything OpenFlow does and a whole lot more. Why wouldn't I just stick with that? There'll be some that would have that mindset.
Well, the flip side is it could go down the tail left path, you know, where people have models and they use protocols like NetConf and Yang to configure it with whatever you like for every device. Yeah. Maybe our software would just get so complicated that the actual protocol underneath, whether it's 1PK or, you know, OpenStack Quantum or OVSDB, you know, Open vSwitch, OF config, doesn't matter.
And I could go there with you a lot quicker because when you begin to model the network as a thing and not a Cisco 4500 or Nexus 7000, it's just a switch and it has these attributes and it doesn't matter what the piece of hardware is. You've got a model that maps those attributes down to whatever the specifics are that switch happens to require to make them to get those features configured. Then that's pretty easy to understand, and TailF's got a real thing going on there where they're doing that, where they've abstracted the network via modeling it to such a degree that it is really irrelevant what the hardware is, whether it's Cisco's or somebody else's. As long as the TailF boss can model that device, whatever it is that you're working on, you can now work on it in the same way using the same code or whatever your interface of choice is. They give you a whole bunch of different interfaces. And that's a pretty easy sell, I think, for a business. They may like it from the standpoint of, I'm still buying Cisco switches, but if I wanted to try a Juniper switch or an HP switch, as long as my TailF box can model it, my engineers don't have to relearn anything. Isn't that a good thing? And you can see that model being extended to just, this is how we do networks now. It's got this hardware has to conform to these standard models.
Yeah, but see, in that world, Cisco gets commoditized again because they just become a model underneath somebody's overlay.
They do in that world, but I see that getting better traction than just OpenFlow on its own.
Yeah,
looking at it from a user perspective, from a business perspective.
True. We should just point out a disclosure here that TailF is a sponsor of the show, and at this particular point in time, we're just editing a show for them. So this isn't sponsored, but we're talking about them because their product is actually quite unique. But just full disclosure is that we have an upcoming show which is sponsored by them.
And Nuage has, you know, we've done some work with them, and of course Cisco, we've done some work with them, just to throw it all out there.
We've been very, very lucky to have them all sponsor us, really. That's an interesting point. So if we start to look at software overlays, which says, well, Cisco's speaking 1PK, and we've got some OpenFlow enabled switches over here that do, you know, OpenFlow for forwarding plane and OVS, OF config for configuration, and a bit of, you know, other stuff to do the rest of the switch configuration. And then over here we've got Juniper with their slacks and their Puppet, you know, capabilities. And over here is Cabletron with their stuff, you know, that whatever, you know.
Interasys, yeah.
Does it really matter? Yeah, sorry, I can't keep thinking of Interasys. I apologize. Do we really care about the hardware? It's really about the software overlay. I mean, you and I were talking backwards and forwards today, and you sort of said to me, you know, configuring VPCs on NanoXOS is really painful. And I said, configuring VPCs at the CLI is a bug, not a feature, right?
Yeah, right, and mostly because it's so error prone. Yeah, you can do it and it's straightforward enough, but you gotta pay attention to what the heck you're doing. Just typing crap in at the CLI seems like the stupid way to be configuring things at this point, because it's so easy to screw it up. So
it's got to span two devices.
Even someone like me, that's a keyboard jockey, I spend lots of time behind a keyboard typing in commands and building configurations and Notepad, double checking them and then pasting them in at the right time. You can still screw up. It's irritating.
I'm not sure, you know, you really have to pay attention, and in the modern era you don't get enough time to pay attention. I struggle to find a concentration span to be able to do those sorts of things. Some days I have to leave until night time just so that I can focus enough to configure it up. I like to think the idea that we would finally find some way to say that the CLI is a power tool. So I've got a blog post somewhere inside of me that says the CLI will always be around. It'll never go away. But in the same way that even Windows had to bring along a PowerShell to be able to give themselves a CLI, I think, you know, networking is going to have to apply a GUI to solve some of these problems.
Yeah, no, I completely agree.
Look at the ASA firewall and its GUI. Admittedly, it's taken 5 years for it to get respectably all right, but it's actually starting to work.
I would much rather edit a rule base with the ASDM, you know, the ASA GUI, ASDM, than hack around at the command line to do that, because the ASDM integrates all the remarks and it shows me the counters in real time and, you know, a bunch of other things that are useful. It's much easier to reorder rules, for example. I can just, you know, click a little arrow, down it goes. Much less chance I'm going to make a mistake, and then and I'm editing it all offline, and then I apply it when I'm done, and I'm satisfied that my policy changes are complete. It's less risky.
That's right.
There is a place for GUIs.
That's right. And if you're using Cisco Security Manager, you can actually track firewall rules across firewalls. So you can actually
I use it every day, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. And the logging gets more significant because you can track the logs on all the firewalls in between. So those types of management tools are things I want to see beefed up. I mean, I don't think Cisco's serious about Cisco Security Manager. For all that, it's a fantastic.
For all it does, there's so much it doesn't do, and there's a lot of pain involved with it. But the certain features of it I do use.
Yeah, constantly.
Quite a bit.
And and every time you use them, you realize how much time just got cut out of your, you know, how much time you just got back in your life. Because of it.
Yeah.
So
very much.
Those are the sorts of tools I want to see developed. I think I actually want to move away from the discussion of SNMP, SSH, HTTPS, XML, REST APIs and get into, I want to be able to configure my IDS and my firewall with one click. So, I create a firewall rule. It should pop up and say, you should be configuring this over on the IDS. You need to put that firewall rule into a group and then apply an IDS policy to it at the same time.
So, okay. So this brings up another really good point here, which is this. Open Daylight Project gotten a lot of traction here, and we're seeing a lot of announcements. And if you're following the Open Daylight mailing list, you're following what's going on with the technical steering committee and so on. There's been a lot of discussion. It's so early in the project now. They're just trying to figure out what the code bases are going to look like and how things are going to all get rolled up together to become a unified project. And then, hey, let's move ahead. One of the things that happened was the code base that was decided upon, as I understand it, has ended up to be largely the Cisco One controller code base. And Big Switch Networks also has a controller. The Floodlight controller is their open source controller, and there was some hope there on the part of Big Switch that their code was going to be merged in some degree with the Cisco One code, and there'd be a new unified code base between the two that would come out of that, and then OpenDaily would go forward in that way. But that didn't happen. What the decision that was made by the folks in the Open Daylight project was, we're going to go with the Cisco One. We're not going to do a merged or a unified code base. And the reaction of Big Switch Network was, okay, fine. Well, we're done with Open Daylight then, and we're just going to march ahead with Floodlight. And they've got momentum with Floodlight. They've got a lot of people that are users of that product, and there's partnerships that Big Switch has developed with folks.
It's proven. It's been out there for a couple of years.
Yeah.
You know, that would have been a really tough decision when you look at it. You know, theoretically, Daylight will form the basis of most controllers going forward. And if what Brent has been telling me is that a lot of that was the code that was originally came out of Stanford from a few years back, when the very first OpenFlow controller was written. And Brent can tell you all the names. And Ethane is the product. So there was an original controller called Ethane that was written in Stanford. And then Floodlight was the second generation or the third generation or something like this. A lot of what Cisco's One code is apparently is related to Ethane. So it will need a lot of work to bring it up to the level of quality that Floodlight is. So Big Switch's position would be, Floodlight has been out there for 3 or 4 years. We've proven it. It's the basis for our commercial controller. You should take this proven code and use that. And it literally was a wrinkle in the organizational fabric, as I understand it, that saw the Cisco code get up for the core, right? Now, that's not to say Cisco's the only person contributing here. NEC has got code to contribute. IBM is really the founder of the Open Daylight project, and they'll love to tell you that Open Daylight was their idea, not Cisco's.
Yeah, lots and lots of vendors who are contributing code, no question. But that you know, this issue, from my perspective, which is going to be more limited than you or Brent, certainly, but you know, this is really focused around that controller piece, that if you want to think of it as middleware, you know, that guy that's sitting right in the middle of everything with his applications on top of him and the hardware underneath him, and what is that code going to be, and who's going to write APIs to speak to that controller, and so on and so forth.
So it's continuing to grow. But as Big Switch says, they should have chosen Floodlight because it's 3 years ahead of where the current code is. Now, arguably, you know, you could take the view on either side.
And I don't even think Big Switch was pushing it that hard. You know, the way I understood the Dixon Erickson proposal was it was going to be a merger of the two code bases into a new, an all new code base that that everyone was going to be able to move ahead with.
Yeah.
So it wasn't even that draconian of Big Switch. Big Switch wasn't really making that tough of a stand the way I saw it.
Sure. Now, well, there's a bunch of other more practical reasons too. The commitment to Open Daylight to be a platinum, gold, whatever, you know, to be a significant contributor, you need to commit 10 engineers at 50% utilization to the project. You also have to stump up a fairly significant amount of cash. And ultimately, Big Switch is a startup, and maybe that commitment is hard. I mean, I read that to be multi-millions. If you figure that you've got to put 10 engineers on the ground for this project, and they've got to travel to wherever these events are and contribute, they're not necessarily a profit source, right?
Certainly not initially, no.
So I look at the Open Daylight project and see them pricing out startups sometimes, and look at it and say, well, you know, there are other people like, where's Embrain? Where's all the smaller startups around the ecosystem that can make, you know, could contribute something? Well, no, IBM and Cisco have bought them, you know, bought their way in by just making the entry price so high that startups would struggle to get in.
I do believe I saw on the mailing list someone from Big Switch saying, you know, that we're evaluating still contributing to the project as a silver level partner, you know, but not platinum. Whether that's going to happen or not, I'm not sure. I haven't read the list today, but
it's a big decision.
That would speak to their startup status. And
it's a big decision. It could go either way, right? Big Switch has a controller, fully functional OpenFlow controller that's in the market and being consumed by customers today. why go and support the Open Daylight project? They've already been running an open flow, an open source project for 3 to 5 years, whatever it is. They have, the leadership. Why should they go and contribute to something just because IBM and Cisco start something up? And if they pull out and then they run their own path, they might be able to forge their own place in the market. There's no guarantee that.
I would agree with that. There's
the free tabs can fail just like any other project.
Yeah, that's right.
Just because it's an open source project.
It's it's because of who's involved with it, though. I mean, that does give it a unique bit of traction. You get Cisco and IBM and NEC and all these other big names that are throwing code at this thing and trying to make all of this stuff work together. Well, there's a reason for that, and it's a commercial one, ultimately, I think. So Big Switch is saying, we think we can make a business based on our existing customer base and what we've got rolling with Floodlight and our commercial control that's based on Floodlight, and so we're going to do that. So is there room for more than one control in the market? I think the answer is yes. How that's going to all settle out is it's wait and see. But then going back to the original point where we kind of segued into this thing, we were talking about applications that plug into a controller and accomplish something straightforward for us, whether that's via GUI or whatever the tool might be. Well, now, if you're an app writer, a network app writer, let's say, or you're a vendor who wants to hook into a controller, now you do have two distinct controllers to be looking at. You've got Floodlight and controllers based on that code, and then you've got whatever Open Daylight becomes.
Yep.
If those are two different things, then that
as long as the northbound APIs
is a sustainable model.
That's right. I mean, as long as the northbound APIs are the same and the southbound API, and the controller supports all the necessary southbound APIs, then why not?
Well, I think that's a big if. Will the northbound APIs be the same? We'll see.
It's an open source project, so theoretically, the Open Daylight APIs will be freely available. They're just APIs. You can't copyright an API.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think you can. Maybe I shouldn't say that. But, the S&P API is pretty little.
No matter how you slice it and what the ultimate outcome of Big Switch pulling out of Daylight is, I think it stinks. It's too bad that it all couldn't come together, but I think it's also inevitable with all of the commercial interests that are represented, interestingly enough, on an open source project. You had to assume at some point something was going to break and something wasn't.
There's a lot of hustle. They want to get it going. I got the opinion from, we had a discussion with David Meyer a couple of weeks back, and I got the opinion that, they want to get moving. So the only way to get moving is to get something done, right? You've got to make a decision and you've got to go with it. If you want to sit down and have a powwow and drink tea and smoke a hookah and have a good chat, then go right ahead. But that's where open source projects fail in a big hurry, is when you start doing those types of things.
Oh, and in the interest of full disclosure, Big Switch has been a customer of ours, and although Open Daylight is an open source project and was not a customer of ours, we have had them on the show as well. we should throw that out there and just mention it. Anyway.
Disclosure. We try to be fair and balanced. So one final topic I wanted to do is one of the things that I've resisted for many years is providing career advice. You and I have talked about this a lot. We felt that giving people advice. But something happened. I'm going to try and give this a run a little bit more, because now when I say career advice, I am not going to start offering advice around whether you should do a CCNA data center or a CCNA security, because that's really only something that you can do. But when you're at work, and it's easy to get stressed, right? It's easy to be passionate about what you're doing. And you want to forge ahead and you want to get onto the next technology and you want to shake the tree and really make something happen. Well, that's kind of great. But you know what? Everybody around you might not want that. And if you are that sort of person, you might be abrasive to all the people around you, and they kind of might hate your guts if you do that. Now, not that I've ever done something like this.
I've never been so abrasive, no, certainly.
I have. One of my problems is I often get passionate or I get excited about a project and I want my point of view to get across, and you know, and I'm driving so hard and I've got all these bright ideas, or what I think are bright ideas, you know, and blah, blah, blah. And you just have a look at the people around you and have some empathy for your coworkers, right? Take some time to relax and just think about some things. Just take time. Here's the classic scenario. I was talking to somebody today. They've just turned up at a brand new company. It's a huge company, big, high profile. They've come in, they've got a, you know, they've been hired during the recruitment phase with the promise that they're going to change something. And they come in through the door and they sit down, and then sure enough, 6 weeks later, everybody's not happy with them because they actually don't really want change. They just said that. So the answer is to just sometimes you have to look at a job and you just have to say, just relax. Some things will take some time. Work at it over time. Because most probably your coworkers just want a hug, a big bag of Doritos, and some quality time in front of the TV. And, you know, it's true, right?
Well, there are few people that are going to be as passionate as you are if you're one of these really driven people that's really into what you do every day. You know, there may be one or two other folks that are, you know, just as wound and excited as you are about your day-to-day job if you're that kind of person. But, Greg, just like you said, if your coworkers aren't there, if they don't match your energy and your enthusiasm, yeah, I mean, people work to make a living, to get a paycheck, by and large, and they got families and other things going on. And hug, big bag of Doritos, quality TV time. Yep, there are people that are in that world, and they don't come home and think about this stuff. And so at work, they're just not as they just don't care as much as you do. Mm. And so that can be a source of frustration for really passionate people when it needn't be, because just chill out. It'll come. It'll come.
Well, so the story I sometimes, or the metaphor I sometimes use when talking to people is that, you know, if you go into a restaurant and you look at, you know, some people are out the back doing the washing up and they're happy doing the washing up, or mopping the floors, or stacking the fridges, or whatever it is, right? And then there's the chef, who's the guy who's running around doing all his thing, but there's a guy behind the chef whose job it is just to chop onions, you know? And then there's the waitress out the front who's running around and doing all the stuff and communicating with all the people, and then there's the guy behind the bar who spends most of your time just sort of standing there going, drinks, you know? It takes all different types of people to make a team, and just because you're pushing at something doesn't mean you should, you know? Sometimes it's okay to just relax, chill out, enjoy life.
I'll throw out a word of caution from personal experience that if you get too wound and too excited in the workplace, it never goes well for you. As someone, you know, speaking personally, who has gotten into, you know, verbal confrontations with folks over things that I saw as issues. That, you know what, at the end of the day, did I have a viewpoint? Yeah. Did I express it well? Well, I expressed it well, real well. but there comes a point where that passion is just misplaced, and you need to, you know, relax and be diplomatic and let things happen. At the end of the day, the business does not rise or fall upon your shoulders, very, very likely. And as a good friend of mine is fond of saying, hey, we're not saving lives here. So, which, depending on your network, maybe you are, but most aren't. So,
I've worked on a few of those.
A little perspective goes a long way in tempering your attitude, you know, on the job. Yeah. And if you relax a little bit, and again, it will come. It gets there.
Yeah. That's my career advice for the year. How's that? Even though I remember saying to you right back when we started, we don't do career advice, but I just felt that it's important to sort of point out to people is when you're gunning for the top, not everybody wants to go with you. So just respect that and try and fit in with the people around you, and your life will be a better place.
Yep, agree.
All right, I think we're just about done. What do you think, Ethan?
I think so. Lots of content in the queue, and Cisco Live coming up, and a good show 150 behind us. Yeah, good place to wrap, I think.
Okay. What do we do for a wrap? Will we do anything special, or we just... I'm going to leave it there. That's it. That's the wrap.
Well, the wrap, of course, for those of you that listen to the show, we do want how to follow us and keep up with us. You know, Twitter's big for us, at Packet Pushers, and we the blog content and the podcast content goes out there. Packetpushers.net is home base. That is where all of our content is featured. Please visit there. The RSS feeds are there. When we change the RSS feeds, they'll be updated there, and so on. And if you want to email us about anything, whatever, including the career advice we don't like to give, packetpushers@gmail.com. And last but not least, Greg, say it with me. Remember that too much networking would never be enough.
Sorry, Mike.
You didn't say it with me.
I was trying to, but I was on mute. I'd muted out.
Okay.
So let's go it again. Hit it again.
Now, Greg, say it with me. Remember that.
Too much networking. Would never be.
Would never be. Coordination fail. It's hard. We're across the ocean from each other. Transatlantic cable, high latency, all of that stuff. It's amazing we get anything recorded at all.
It is.
And fade to black.
Okay.
Okay. That's good.